So I have one message during this lecture. And if you come away with just this, I have succeeded. And the message is, don't give up. Don't give up on these patients. Don't abandon them because they look too sick. Don't abandon them because they're unconscious. Don't give up on them. There's a sense of clinical nihilism with cardiac arrest because we've seen such dismal outcomes in the past. And I watch it in other hospitals I visit, I watch it in my own colleagues, that if a patient looks incredibly sick, there's this sense they're not going to make it and the clinical efforts diminish. Don't give up. Let me tell you a story. A story about Mr. W. He's a 28-year-old male. He's eating dinner with his family, and he suddenly collapsed. He's unconscious. They check a pulse. There's no pulse. They call the ambulance. 20 minutes later, because this is New York City, the fire department gets there, and they start resuscitation. They find the patient in V-fib. They shock him. And 25 minutes later, he has a pulse, and they bring him to our hospital. We'll talk a little bit more about Mr. W in the coming minutes. What we're going to talk about is after the arrest. Last year, you heard about hypothermia. You heard a lecture from Tyler already about intra-arrest clinical benefits. This is going to be after the pulse comes back, the post-resuscitation syndrome. As Andy said, my name is Scott Weingart. I'm the director of emergency critical care at Mount Sinai. What I've devoted my career to is this concept of bringing upstairs care, ICU level care, downstairs to the emergency department where it belongs. These patients deserve the same level of care regardless of their geography. They shouldn't get a higher standard just because they make it upstairs to the ICU. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. I'm not taking money from anyone right now. Wish I was. This, for a long time, was the missing link in the chain. The chain of survival put out by the American Heart is there on the left. And there was nothing about post-resuscitation care at all. I had to make my own little link in the chain. And so I designed this little link, and I talked about it for a couple of years. Finally, they've added the link themselves. It looks a lot like my link. I'm not sure if there's any copyright violations here, but it's there now. They acknowledge that this is just as important as what you do during the arrest. They put out an advisory statement along with the International Liaison Council on Resuscitation, and it's pretty good. It's worth reading. The references are on that little zip drive you guys got. You could look it up. It's about 30 pages worth of actual useful information, and they describe the post-arrest syndrome. Worth a read. But what I thought was really important about it was that it gave a name to all these concepts we're going to talk about. And lacking a name, an idea doesn't really exist. You could, you know, go to your friend and say, yeah, he was really sick. I don't think his heart was working. And that might mean something. But if you say he had post-cardiac arrest myocardial dysfunction, now you actually have a syndrome you could talk about, you could quantify. And that's where things really start getting done, both in the research and the clinical realm. So now we have names for all these things that happen after a cardiac arrest. I can't do this lecture without talking about the grandfather of post-resuscitation care. And it's that hair-challenged gentleman on the left. That's Vladimir Nagoski. He was talking about this stuff before I was born. In the 1970s, he was already describing each aspect of the post-cardiac arrest syndrome. A man who was visionary, did experiments, proved all this stuff exists. It was roundly ignored for about 30 years until, you know, the past couple years, people have been starting to rediscover this stuff. All right, let's start off talking about the first 20 minutes after they bring the patient in, they've gotten their pulse back. Now, these first 20 minutes usually look like a pretty sunny time. You know, everything looks great. The vitals are good. The paramedics are high-fiving because they brought a patient back. Everyone's really happy. And the tendency is to walk away from that bedside. All right, the patient's blood pressure is 160 over 80. They're looking okay. Maybe they're unconscious, but they're intubated. Everything seems fine. And people walk away from the bedside. And then they actually seem shocked when the patient codes again a half hour later. Don't be shocked. It's inevitable. This is not up sunny time. This is storm clouds on the horizon. That's what you should be thinking when a patient comes in with good vital signs after an arrest. Because what's going on is they have all those catecholamines that have been pushed into their system during the resuscitation. They have more than like 100 times physiologic dose of epinephrine going on in there. Yeah, their blood pressure is going to be good for a little while. It's going to plummet. It's not something you should be surprised about. It's something you should be expecting. And since that's the case, you should not squander this time. Use this time. Get all the lines and get your A line in. Get your central venous line in now while the blood pressure is good. Get your EKG and screen them for STEMI. Start hypothermia now before they get hemodynamically stable. Don't squander this time. This time is valuable, and this might be your only moment to have a breather and be able to get things done before the really rocky road starts. The next 6 to 24 hours are that rocky road. And the longer they were down, the longer their time until they got their pulse back, the worse it's going to be. You take someone, you had a witness V-fib because they came in with a STEMI tier ED, and you shock them, they were out for maybe 30 seconds, you know. They come right back. They're talking to you. They're screaming because they saw that light at the end of the tunnel. That's a patient you don't have to really worry about, this post-resuscitation syndrome. But if they've been down for a while, it's going to be tough. And the longer they were down, the tougher it's going to be. There's essentially four elements of the post-resuscitation syndrome we're going to talk about. And we'll go through each one. We're going to start talking about the post-arrest brain injury. Now, the mechanisms are varied. They could fill up an entire page in small font type, and I'm not going to go through that. You know, it's still morning. You folks will fall asleep if I try that. I mean, essentially, this is just a brief synopsis of all the bad things that happen to you, both from the ischemia and, just as importantly, from the reperfusion. Both of those hurt your brain. More important than the mechanisms is what we could actually do about them. That's what we care about, right? We want the clinical endpoint. What could we do to fix these things? And the easy answer is we could do induced hypothermia. And pretty much every single problem caused by that ischemia and reperfusion can be addressed by a hypothermia. So the question becomes, who do we cool? Who is it actually worth doing hypothermia on? Can we get an audience response? Oh. All right, so just one is yes, two is no. The question is, how many folks in the audience are cooling out of hospital V-fib or VTAC arrest? All right, so we're about 50-50 split. To the folks that are doing it, good for you. To the folks that aren't, and I don't want to make any statements of standard of care because then that brings into all sorts of medical legal stuff, but it's pretty damn close. For this group, VFib, VTAC, out of hospital, to not offer hypothermia is really a problem right now because there's been too much out there on the benefits. It's not just one study. It's not just two studies. It's not just 10 studies. It's every single study has shown near equivalent benefit in this patient group, and the benefits are dramatic. We're talking from 25% of patients leaving the hospital with good neurologic outcome jumping up to 50%. I mean, those aren't numbers you could really ignore. Now, the next question is a little more ambiguous. So let's try one more time. How many folks are cooling any rhythm that comes through the door? So definitely, and that's expected, and that might be clinical doubt on the evidence base. It might just be you don't want to devote the resources until they actually force the issue. I'll tell you, I've been to a number of scientific assemblies in the critical care world and specifically in the hypothermia world. The evidence for this is coming too. So if you're not ready to start gearing up, now's the time. Pretty much you'll be cooling every single rhythm that comes through the door within the next year, is my prediction. All right, here's who I recommend you cool. And I can't make it any simpler than this. If you have a non-trauma post-arrest patient, so, you know, traumatic arrest is an entirely different animal, not advocating you cool those guys yet, but non-trauma post-arrest who doesn't follow commands, so that means their GCS motor score less than 6, and you're deciding to admit them to an ICU. That's it. If they meet this qualification, in my opinion, and the opinion of folks much smarter than me on hypothermia, these are the folks you now should be cooling. So think about that. It pretty much embraces everything. If you get that 88-year-old from the nursing home who has forward dementia, you can't make them any better than they were with hypothermia. It's not a Lazarus pill. So for those folks, you really shouldn't be admitting them to the ICU. So therefore, they shouldn't get cooling. There's no point to that. But for pretty much everyone else, if they deserve an intensive care package, they deserve all those resources, then they deserve hypothermia. Because once they go to the ICU, adding hypothermia really isn't that big of a deal. It's still the same nursing level, it's still the same resources. As long as you don't use a very expensive machine, it's not even more costly. To cool a patient in my shop costs about $25. That's the cost of the ice saline and the blankets we use that are linked to a machine from the 1970s. So there's really no economic reason not to, and it doesn't make it any easier to care for these patients not to cool them. All right, so hypothermia is the one. If you want to make the patient's brain better, you'll induce hypothermia, 32 to 34 degrees C for 24 hours, and you're going to have a dramatic increase in the patients who leave the hospital able to go back to their lives. There's some other good stuff we could do as well. We could optimize their respiratory system. And this means euoxemia and eucapnia. Now, euoxemia means you want their saturation around 95%. You don't want it 100%. A, you know, it's unnecessary. B, it's going to hurt the lungs. But more importantly, it's going to hurt this damaged brain. Free radical formation from hyperoxia is a demonstrated phenomenon. Now, the evidence is not robust, but it's just good critical care not to leave these patients on an FiO2 of 100% if they don't need it. So 95% is where you shoot for. Eucapnia, just like a brain injury patient. You want them around 35 to 37, 38. You know, you don't want them hypercapnic. You don't want them too far in the hyperventilation range. So then that nice, gentle 35 to 38 sounds just about right. If the patient does have any reactions to pain or stimuli, they need a good sedation and analgesia package. In rats at least, if you had a hypothermia induction on a rat, and ordinarily their outcomes would be good, if you left them agitated, all the benefits disappeared. Because essentially what you're trying to do with hypothermia, at least partially, is decrease cerebral metabolism. Now all of a sudden you have an agitated patient in pain, and God forbid you paralyze them too and they're under-sedated, that's not going to help their cerebral metabolism. Their brain's going to be going crazy. So you have to sedate these patients, and you have to have a good analgesia package. The way we manage it is we put them on fentanyl right up front, take away the pain, we get some sedative effects from that as well, and then we'll add on propofol early on if there's any signs they need further sedation. But Versed, Ativan, those would work fine as well. I really like the fentanyl. It's a little bit more hemodynamically stable than morphine, but morphine would be okay too if that's all you had. All right, there is one of these complex neurologic phenomena I want you to understand. In the neurocritical care world, it's called no reflow. And the idea is that during that ischemic period and then during the reperfusion phase, in all the little microvessels in the brain, there's sludging, there's clotting, there's vasospasm. And as a result, blood and oxygen does not get to these brain tissues in these injured areas. And in ischemic brain, unfortunately, it's a global phenomenon. Now, they call it no reflow, but that's a misnomer. It's a dynamic process. You actually can make this better. One of the easy ways to make it better is to give more cerebral perfusion. Now, most of these patients in the ED do not have intracranial monitors. They don't have a spike in their head that's going to tell you what their ICP is. So you can't really calculate out cerebral perfusion, so you just have to do it empirically. And the way we do that is with a MAP push. So you're going to push your mean arterial blood pressure at the very least to 65. And that's just good critical care for any patient. But if you can, if it's not going to take too much fluid or pressors or inotropes, you should really push these folks to a MAP of 80. And if you manage to do that, then you're conquering somewhat this dynamic reflow phenomenon. And you're going to get more blood to the areas of the brain that need it. Glucose is a big deal in the critical care world. There's debate back and forth constantly. And, you know, the debate is almost out of proportion to how little the benefits actually were in all but one study. But recently, there's a study called NICE that was released, and there was a study specifically in cardiac arrest patients, and both of them say the same thing. You want to have a reasonable control of these patients' blood sugar, but you do not want tight control. You don't have to have your nursing staff there doing finger sticks every 10 minutes to get these patients down to a glucose of 80, as some have advocated in the past. 180 is a very nice number to work with. If you wanted to push it in the emergency department to even 200, I say go for it. And that's, I think, fairly reasonable. You don't want these patients dramatically hyperglycemic, but 180 to 200 is a very easy goal to actually master. You definitely don't want them hypoglycemic. If you give an ischemic brain hypoglycemia as well, pretty much, you know, game is over. So 180 to 200, very nice place to keep your glucose. You could try subcutaneous insulin. It usually will work if these patients are somewhat perfused. If they're not, sometimes you have to go to an insulin drip. All right, that was post-arrest brain injury. Now we're going to deal with these two middle phenomenon. And they both relate to hemodynamic instability. Anyone who starts a hypothermia program, what they're going to find is, as soon as a patient gets hemodynamically unstable, people blame the hypothermia. Hypothermia is always the villain here. Hypothermia did not cause the hemodynamic instability. Hypothermia, at the ranges we use, does not cause hemodynamic instability. The hemodynamic instability is caused first by the ischemia reperfusion response. So they got ischemic, just like the brain, the rest of your body got ischemic, and then it reperfused, and it has injuries from both. There's an article in Circulation 2002 which compared the post-arrest to a sepsis-like syndrome. And it's not just close, it's almost exactly the same. Every cytokine that goes up when you're septic goes up in the post-arrest state as well. So the nice thing is, if you know how to treat sepsis, you know how to treat the post-arrest patient. You guys have all heard this term, SIRS, right? I mean, it's been bandied around for 5 years now, almost constantly. The systemic inflammatory response syndrome. That's essentially what this ischemia reperfusion response is. So these patients are going to have leaky vasodilated vessels, right? That's part of sepsis. They get vasodilated, they leak into their interstitium. So to fix that, we have to ensure adequate preload. Now, because of the cardiac tinge to cardiac arrest, people often feel you can't give these patients fluid. Their hearts are failing, you're going to put them into pulmonary edema, let's keep them dry. I've even seen Lasix being given. Don't do it. These aren't your MI patients. This is a whole different syndrome. These post-arrest patients' pipes are dilated and leaky. They need a ton of fluid. Now, if you induce hypothermia the way I advocate, you're already giving them fluid because isaline is, bar none, the quickest and most efficient way to get these patients cooled down for their induction phase. Sometimes you have to keep going past the 2 to 3 liters you gave them to induce your hypothermia. So the question then becomes, how do you know if you have adequate preload? It's not an easy question. It's actually one of the hardest questions in critical care. Now, Peter W. is lecturing after me on hypotension. He's going to talk about a lot of these methods, so I'm not going to go into them. I'm just going to tell you my favorite for the emergency department, because this is just so cool. Now, you should be nursing all these patients with the head of the bed at 45 degrees. We'll talk about why in just a moment. So you have your patient, they're sitting up 45 degrees. All you do is you step on that foot pedal that drops the head of the bed down without dropping the feet. Your beds all have them, right? Yeah? You know, the one that drops the head for Trendelenburg. All right, well, if you have it 45 degrees and you hit that pedal down by the head, what happens is their head's now going to be flat and their legs are going to be up at 45 degrees, right? Well, if you do that, over the next minute, if their blood pressure goes up, they need fluid. It's just that simple. It's called passive leg raise, and I think it's just the easiest, best way to assess things in the ED for fluid resuscitation. So you do this. It's easier if you have an A-line because you see an instantaneous spike. But if you don't, it's okay. You just have to hit that start button as soon as you do this. And by the time the blood pressure actually registers, it's just about a minute. But if you have an A-line in, this is just beautiful because you do not need to give fluid at that point to see if the patient will respond. And doing this, they'll respond to about 500 to 1,000 cc's of fluid if they get a blood pressure response from this. Cool, right? All right, you have to make sure they have adequate afterload. And we talked about the MAP of 65 at least during the brain injury portion. Same thing here. You want at very least 65, and probably pushing to the 80 for the brain is better. Just like sepsis, they need adequate hemoglobin. Now, as to what that number is, it's really, really hard to say. The evidence keeps going back and forth. I can tell you with certainty, you should not be letting these patients drop below 7. Some would even argue with certainty 8. Manny Rivers got involved with the post-arrest syndrome as well. He was on that advisory statement. He wants 10 if the patient's showing signs of decreased oxygenation in their tissues. And there's probably something to it, but there's no evidence. So I can tell you definitively, keep them above 7 to 8, maybe push them to 10 if they're showing signs of not getting enough oxygen to their tissues. Which begs the next point. How do you check if they're getting enough oxygen to their tissues? This is always another hard question in critical care and emergency medicine as well. First thing you can do is you look at the lactate. And you should be definitely getting lactates on these patients. Problem is, after a cardiac arrest, their lactates are going to be sky high. So in the ED, what you should be looking for is that the lactate's coming down. If they're clearing the lactate, you should feel pretty good about what's going on with these patients. It might not get to normal while they're with you, but at least it's going in the right direction. I think it's worth sending a central venous oxygen saturation at some point on these patients. Now, if you have those Edwards catheters, great, you're getting a continuous reading. I don't have them. I don't need them. I haven't fought to get them with my hospital. We just take a blood gas off the distal port of our central line, as long as that line's in the neck, and we get a saturation from that blood gas. That's your central venous oxygen saturation. Less than 70, you probably have a problem. You gotta make sure you optimize your preload, your afterload, and your hemoglobin. If it's greater than 70, you're probably doing pretty good. All right, you get all the bad things from this SIRS response as well, which means these patients are hypercoagulable, they're immunosuppressed, and they're starved because we're not feeding them. So even though it's not classically an ED thing, I think in these patients it's worth to at least consider providing DVT prophylaxis with heparin or Lovenox, ventilator-associated pneumonia prophylaxis, keeping their head in the bed up and good pulmonary toilet, and stress ulcer prophylaxis with an H2 blocker or PPI. If you don't do it, okay, you might have more important things to worry about. But if you can think about this stuff, this is the kind of thing I'm talking about when I say bring upstairs care downstairs. This is standard of care in the ICU. The DVT risk starts pretty much the second they got their pulse back because of the hypercoagulable state of the post-arrest syndrome. And PE is not a good way to go out after you've already done all the work to save these patients from their original arrest. Lung protective ventilation. Their lungs are going to take a hit. Any SIRS response is going to cause lung damage. Then you put them on the ventilator, you get ventilator-associated lung damage. You can prevent this, or at least ameliorate the effects. Every single patient that's intubated in my ED gets lung protective ventilation. But if you don't buy that, and the evidence is mounting, at least buy it in these patients post-arrest. They need low tidal volume ventilation, which is a max of 8 cc's per kg, and they need their PEEP optimized. In your handout is my protocol for post-arrest, and it will discuss this in more depth. Due to time, I'm not going to talk to you about PEEP optimization. That's a whole other lecture. But if you follow this lung protective ventilation in these patients, their lungs are going to do better. It's the only evidence-based strategy that's shown mortality benefit for ventilator management. All right. If any of you are sleeping, if any of you haven't been listening so far, listen to this next part, most important part of the lecture. Post-arrest myocardial depression. It's the second reason for that hemodynamic instability. It's also called cardiac stunning, What happens is a nice normal heart after the arrest just doesn't work so well. Why is this happening? Same cascade that goes on in sepsis, tumor necrosis factor, a whole bunch of cytokines you don't really care about is one of the main reasons. The other reason is probably iatrogenic. We probably give way too much catecholamine, and then that heart has to deal with it after they get their pulse back. But for whatever reason, when you slap the echo probe on these patients post-arrest, what you're going to see is you're going to see a ventricle that's doing one of these jobs. Nice little 10-15% ejection fraction. And you look at that and you're like, this is dismal. And if you have your cardiology colleagues see these patients, or you send them to the CCU, what happens is they get dubbed cardiogenic shock. And all of you had experience with cardiogenic shock, you know the outcomes are very poor. Anything short of a heart transplant in that postpartum cardiomyopathy, these severe cardiogenic shock patients don't do so well. And the cardiologists see this, and this is where the clinical nihilism starts, is they see this heart, they start writing notes on their chart like, patient with severe diminishment of cardiac function, unlikely to survive, go palliative route. And I've seen this happen. I've seen it even happen in the ED with folks who have experience with cardiogenic shock. They say, this patient's not going to make it. We might as well throw in the towel. This is a reversible phenomenon. If you give this heart 24 to 48 hours, it will recover function. It will go back to normal as long as there was no intrinsic cardiac damage. So you cannot write these patients off just because their heart looks like crap when they hit the door. These patients can go to have normal cardiac function very frequently. So how are you going to treat this if you're not going to write them off? Well, you're going to give them inotropes right off the bat. Now, inotropes have excellent evidence if you're a pig. Human data is not there. I can tell you, if you slap the echo probe on after you put the inotropes, their heart starts beating more normally. Does that translate to mortality? I can't tell you. But it works to get that actual outcome you want immediately, which is the heart moving, blood pressure gets better. The U.S., it's usually going to be dobutamine. If the patient was on a beta blocker, it might be worth moving to an agent that has a different receptor site. You can use milrinone. ED, folks are usually more familiar with dobutamine. That's absolutely fine. 5 to 20 micrograms per kilogram per minute is your dose. In the future, there's actually a calcium agonist, levosimendan. They're using it in Europe. Has a lot of promise. Not here yet. If the inotropes fail, these folks need a balloon pump. Now, balloon pump's not an ED procedure yet. I think with ultrasound, there's no reason it shouldn't be in the future. But these folks deserve a trip to the lab and get a balloon pump if their heart's still failing. It's aggressive, but because of the reversibility, it's worth doing. But if you think a balloon pump's aggressive, wait till you hear what I have next. The future of this is extracorporeal life support, ECMO bypass. Now you're going to say, I'm nuts. Well, these guys are nuts too. They're a Taiwanese group, and they actually took patients who were getting CPR, and it was an observational trial, so part of the group got just standard CPR. The other part got a crash bypass. And they did a propensity analysis. They tried to match these folks up as best as possible. The results were dramatic. Odds ratio of 0.5 in terms of survival to leave the hospital, 30-day survival was still statistically significant. 1-year survival was still statistically significant. This is published in The Lancet. This is amazing stuff. It wasn't even their first study. It was the fourth. The signal is there. These folks, in the future, I think, will be put on bypass because of the reversibility of this phenomenon. Now, you don't need an enormous machine. You don't need perfusionists. This machine was just FDA approved by Maquette. It's a full bypass machine, has the oxygenator in there, and that's a flight medic holding it in her hand. It's the size of one of your transport monitors. So essentially now the barrier is just getting access to an artery and a vein. This is on the horizon. All right, let's talk about pre-arrest pathology. Because something made these folks code in the first place, and that didn't magically go away just because they got their pulse back. So you have to ask yourself for every arrest, why did it happen? And the big masquerader is always that pulmonary embolism. So you consider what happened before their arrest, you consider how they look now, maybe you take a look at that right heart on the echo, and you say, is there a chance this patient has PE? And oftentimes we're going to get empiric CT angiograms on these patients if we have no other reason on their way up to the ICU to figure out if that was the cause. If they do have a big PE, they need treatment. Now, if you have a center that's going to take these patients to embolectomy, great. I don't have that center. So for these folks, thrombolysis is indicated, and without it, they're probably going to code again. And we'll talk about thrombolytics again in 2 seconds. You have to screen them for STEMI. And if they do have a STEMI, even though they were post-arrest, even though they might have hypothermia on board, they need to take a trip to the cath lab, if that's possible. The Europeans are actually advocating any arrest without clear pathology goes to the PCI lab, because a number of these patients turn out to have a cardiac, a coronary occlusion, even though they didn't show a STEMI on their EKG. U.S., it's a little tougher. Some states are trying to do it. Arizona, Ben Bobrow, he's trying to get this done, and I think it will be there in the future. Some folks, no matter what, no matter how convincing you are, no matter how big those ST elevations, you can't take these patients to the lab. In New York, our cardiologists, our interventional cardiologists, are told any death goes against them on their report card. Doesn't matter if they're post-arrest or not. They're very unwilling to screw up their stats with patients who oftentimes get made DNR and withdrawn upon. So they're not willing to take these patients to the lab. And then what you're left with is thrombolytics. And you can thrombolyze these patients. There is an evidence base for it. We've done a couple. We've been, you know, basically on tether hooks throughout it. It's very scary, but it is safe. And that advisory I showed you, that ILCOR AHA advisory, actually put into writing now that you can give thrombolytics post-arrest. So now you have a standard of care support as well, saying not that you have to do it, but if you do and there's a bad outcome, at least these major organizations said it's okay. Let's go back to my friend, Mr. W. Again, just to remind you, he's a 28-year-old. He's eating dinner and collapsed, pulseless. They called the ambulance. It took 20 minutes for them to get there. Actually, 25 minutes after getting losing his pulse, he got shot and got the pulse back. And he came to my ED. So we had those first 20 minutes. The first thing I do is a neuro exam. It's very embarrassing. After you have, you know, sedated this patient, sent them upstairs, and they ask you what was his brainstem response when he first got here, and you have no idea. This takes 20 seconds to do, because you're not doing a full neurologic exam. You're doing your Glasgow coma. You're seeing how the patient reacts to pain primarily is what you want, because they're intubated, and generally if they're not reacting on their motor score, they're not going to have verbal or eye movements either. And then you just do some brainstem reflexes. So you actually do your corneals, you see if their pupils react, you see if they have a gag, you see if they're overbreathing the vent. You finished your basic neuro exam on these patients for those first 5 minutes or so. I have one of the nurses get a rectal temp right up front, I'll tell you why, and I get a 12-lead EKG. Generally, approaching these patients, we get one doctor, two nurses, and this is exactly what we're doing in those first couple of minutes. Then we're going to start hypothermia. I have my rectal temp now. That's all I need to start hypothermia. I don't need a research protocol. I don't need to call someone in. I don't need to get a machine. I don't need to wrap a patient in blankets. I don't need to put in a catheter. I just need my rectal temperature and that peripheral IV line that EMS put in for me. Because all I'm doing is I'm walking over to the refrigerator and taking out a bag of isaline and I'm hanging it under pressure. I actually use a level 1. Not with a heating circuit, of course, but just a pressurized circuit, and I'm pushing in that fluid as quick as I possibly can. And that's all you need to start hypothermia. That's your induction right there. Forget about everything else. You want a time from door to induction of about 2 minutes. And it's just that easy as hanging that bag of isaline. Where we're at now, we're looking for 1 degree Celsius every 10 minutes, which means if this patient comes in at 37, I have them down to 34 in about a half hour. In order to do that, if you pressurize in your isaline, it takes about a liter for every degree Celsius. So every 10 minutes, they're getting a liter of fluids, and they're getting down 1 degree Celsius. And we've demonstrated these rates time and time again. So it can be done very quickly with no equipment whatsoever. Now, at some point, we're going to get that cooling blanket on the patient, but it's not important during those first 5 minutes. All right. At this point, we're sending labs, whole rainbow, ABG, lactate, and we're doing a rush exam. I talked about that last year. For anyone not familiar, it's essentially a screen for hypotension with ultrasound. We perform an echo. We look for pneumothorax that might have been induced by the compressions of CPR. We take a look in the belly for free fluid. We look at the aorta. We take a look at the IVC to see if it's pump and fluid filled or empty and fluid depleted. And that's ultrasound done right after they hit the door because you're looking for that etiology of the arrest. All right, at this point we have a little time. We're still in those first 20 minutes. They get a sterile neckline, either subclavian or IJ. They get a femoral A-line, an OG tube, a Foley catheter, and an esophageal temp probe. I'll take just a second to talk about why an esophageal temp probe. How many folks are using rectal probes? Just a show of hands. All right, bunch. How many are using esophagus? Oh, okay. Well, my resident's great. And how many are using bladder? Okay. This is a report we just put in resuscitation this month. Simultaneous measuring of rectal temperature and esophageal temperature. And you can see over the course of 20 minutes, that rectal temperature doesn't budge, while the esophageal is almost real time. And this patient got to 34 degrees in the 20 minutes, and they stayed by rectal probe still at 35.5. You'd still be flooding this patient with fluid if you're using a rectal probe. And unfortunately, I have to tell you, the bladder probe is just as bad. They are very accurate when there's a steady state. They have no ability to follow rapid changes at all. You want to drop an esophageal probe during your induction phase. Now, in the ICU, if they want to use rectal or bladder, they can knock themselves out because the temperature variance is 0.3 degrees either direction because they're maintaining the patient. But when you're inducing them, this is the probe you should switch to. All right, we place them on the cooling machine. Again, it wasn't a priority. That ice saline was the priority. We wrap them with blankets, and we put them with our 1970s piece of equipment. The biggest problem you're going to have during this phase is shivering. And the more they shiver, the more they make your job miserable, the better their chance they're going to have a good outcome. Because when that shivering response is totally diminished, it speaks less powerfully to their ability to have good neurologic effect. Now, don't look at that and say they're not shivering, so they're not going to have a chance. Say, if they are shivering, it's worth working to counter it because these patients have the best shot. So for shivering on this patient and on most of our patients, we start off with fentanyl. We get both pain control and an anti-shivering response. We had to add on propofol because he was still shivering. At that point, we added on magnesium. And if you have to, we didn't need to on this patient, but if you have to, you can give paralysis for the induction. Now, I don't like paralysis left on. I don't think you should, once you get to temp, leave them paralyzed, because actually getting to your goal temperature will diminish the shivering response. There's a cutoff in your body where if you get them low enough, the shivering response diminishes and disappears. That's why you wind up dying when you're exposed to the environment. So for the induction, if you need to, you can give them a shot of vecuronium, but don't keep doing it. This patient didn't need it. And he definitely manifested the hemodynamic instability I told you about. He required a ton of fluid, about 6 liters. He got put on norepinephrine, and he actually did require dobutamine for his cardiac dysfunction after the arrest. So he got all those. He got some calcium, because without calcium, your heart's not going to beat well, so you want to optimize the calcium in these patients. We did all that housekeeping stuff. He got heparin. He got a PPI, got the head of his bed up, and we did lung protective ventilation. And then after that, we did neuro checks every half hour or so, shivering checks every half hour, sedation checks every half hour. He was actually with us for 15 hours in our department. All right, so we'll come back to him in a second. Let's just review. First 20 minutes. Everything looks really rosy there, but it's going to get worse. Don't squander the time. Use it to get things done. Post-arrest brain injury is what led to the devastating outcomes after arrest. These patients would go home to a nursing home, not what we want. Hypothermia changed the game. Patients who had no brainstem reflexes at arrival go home to their family as normal people. The ischemia reperfusion response is just like sepsis. You know how to treat sepsis, treat it the same way. Post-arrest myocardial depression will show you a heart that looks horrible, and if you watch them 24 or 48 hours later, normal heart function. The pre-arrest pathology, screen for it. Whatever caused the arrest, still there, lurking, waiting to make your patient recode. All right, all the references for this can be found at a site, New York City Hypothermia, nychypothermia.org, which I created with one of the most brilliant guys in neurocritical care, Stefan Mayer. These are all in your handouts. These, you don't have to write them down. You can contact me at me@mcrit.org, also in your handout. Just a little plug. I have a podcast and a blog now where I talk about emergency critical care issues. This is the address. Write this one down. There's no advertising. I make no money off it. I just really love to talk about this stuff, and I would so love to hear your comments. All right, let's get back to Mr. W. He turned out to have Brugada syndrome as the cause of his arrest in a 28-year-old. He got an implanted defibrillator, and this is a picture I took of him 8 days after his arrest. He was fully neurologically intact. He was so neurologically intact that he was worried about the immigration effects of me taking this picture. So this guy went home normal. So if you get them through the first 48 hours, things could get much better. Don't give up on these patients. Do not throw in the towel. Do not have clinical nihilism. Do not give up on them hemodynamically. Do not give up on them neurologically. Don't give up. They could go home to their families. Thank you.